From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Psycho Killer. That song launched Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth's career with the Talking Heads. Coming up, we meet two of the founding members of one of today's most innovative bands. Also today, a talk with espionage writer Robert Ludlum, author of the bestsellers The Bourne Identity and The Icarus Agenda, and former pitchman for Cigars and Tuna Helper. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the Smithsonian's new collection of the best in American musical comedy. And Ken Tucker reviews a movie now out on home video, I Want to Hold Your Hand. It's Robert Zemeckis' 1978 film about a group of Beatles fans desperately trying to meet their idols. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The band Talking Heads started playing the New York punk clubs in the mid-70s, and as rock critic Ken Tucker has written, the band came to symbolize New York new wave at its naughtiest. Their initially terse, squawking, demotic sound summed up all that was eccentric and anti-commercial about the lower Manhattan scene. Talking Heads are still together, and they've become one of the most innovative bands of the past decade. My guests are the band's drummer, Chris Franz, and bassist, Tina Weymouth. They're married and have two children. Since 1980, in addition to their work with Talking Heads, they've had their own band, Tom Tom Club, which has had a couple of dance hits. Next week, Tom Tom Club starts a 2-month concert tour. They also have a new album called Boom Boom Cha Boom Boom. This is the opening track. Franz and Tina Weymouth, welcome to Fresh Air. Describe to us why you formed this group.
One day we woke up and we found out we didn't have any money in the bank, and so we decided better get to work. And this is because even though the Talking Heads was doing really well, we had gone on the road with a band of 9 people or something like that, and we were traveling in airplanes everywhere and staying in fancy hotels and things like that, and we did a very successful tour which made no money, in fact almost put us into the hole. And so David was doing this thing called the Catherine Wheel on Broadway, and Jerry Harrison was doing an album called The Red and the Black, a solo album, and Tina and I said to each other, we better think of something to do. And we went to a friend named Chris Blackwell, who owns Island Records, and he said, I'll give you a chance that you can make a single, and if the single does well, then you can make an entire album. And we thought that was a nice, fair offer. And so we made the single, and I think it went to number one in 7 countries. It was called Wordy Rapping Hood, and it was a prototypical rap song, or homage to rap music, which at that time, we're talking 1980, was still a new and, as you would say, fresh type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then that led to an album, and then that led to a second album, and then Talking Heads got real busy, and with movies and tours and things like that, and so there was no time for Tom Tom Club anymore, but now Talking Heads is like a band that makes an album every other year, so we got loads of time for the Tom Tom Club, and we're I guess you could say we're pretty much starting over. like a new band.
Mm-hmm.
And we're coming to your town.
Yeah, you're doing what, a 20 city tour?
At least 20. I don't know. I stopped counting after the first month.
Well, Tina, you sing on the Tom Tom Club records. Had you sung before the group got together?
I sang once with my sisters, Laura and Lonnie, who eventually joined me for Tom Tom Club. I sang with Brian Eno on a David Byrne song, called Air. And it was a great song, and we called ourselves the Sweetbreaths, and we sang this kind of like, Air, you know, type of thing. And that was our first chance to get to sing, and it was really exciting. And so later, when we started doing it with Tom Tom Club, we continued to use the voice as an instrument and words as sound, as opposed to featuring it as a character in the song. Although Wordy Rapping Hood was very full of characters, kind of like the Muppets, though, more than say what had been going on with the music at that time. So people found it very goofy and funny. And now I guess you could say we've sort of moved away from that dance thing, because while we're still kind of working parallel to the hip hoppers and rappers, what they do is so different from what we do, because we work in a live situation with a band that can actually tour, and we don't use very many samples. We do use them a little bit, but not very often. So we've been
schools. Excuse me for interrupting here, Tina, but there's like two different schools of thought about live performance now. One is that you should sound just like your record, exactly, and you should have a big extravagant show to sort of relate to the video that you made somehow, and preferably you tie in a major corporation which manufactures either soft drinks or suntan lotion or shoes. That's one school of thought, and you go out and you really clean up. The other school of thought is that you sit down and you actually sort of figure out how to make the show exciting on your own terms. Like, you rely on yourself and you don't rely on the technology and the big bucks from, you know, Diet Colas. And you go out there, and maybe it doesn't sound exactly like the record, but hopefully the audience is transported even further than they would be by just hearing a record coming over a stereo. So we're of the second school of thought, where we go out with fewer musicians that are on the record, smaller venues than we actually could be playing if we wanted to play bigger ones, so that we can have an intimacy, and a really low-budget production. Mm-hmm. You know.
Let me play something else from your new record. And my guests are Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth, who they're drummer and bass player, respectively, and play a lot of other instruments as well. They're the rhythm section of the Talking Heads, and they have their own group, Tom Tom Club, which has a new record, their first in several years. The album's called Boom Boom Cha Boom Boom. Did I do that okay? I was telling you, I was dreading having to say this on the air.
That was just perfect.
You did that really well.
Yeah, well, I'm going to play what's going to be the single released from this album. It's called Sub Oceana. From the Tom Tom Club's new album, Boom Boom Cha Boom Boom, and that's their single, Sub Oceana. Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth are my guest. Let's talk a little bit about how you first got together, how Talking Heads first got together. You were both students at the Rhode Island School of Design in the 70s when, I think when you met.
And, that's correct.
And also when you started playing together. What was the balance in your lives between art and music? Did you see yourselves heading in more visual art directions or music directions when you were in college?
Well, I was always doing both. I actually performed at the World's Fair in 1964 as a child. I was a handbell ringer. That's pretty funny, isn't it? And I loved that, you know, and I always loved the stage and performance. And but at the same time, I was studying art at the Corcoran. This was in Washington, D.C., and one of my teachers was Mark Rothko, who's just about my favorite painter in the world. And I was always doing both, and I think that's true for Chris as well, wasn't it, Chris?
Yes. I started playing music when I was in, I guess, the second or third grade, something like that. I started off, I didn't have English handbells at my school. We had flutophones. We started off on the flutophone. And one thing led to another, and I ended up playing drums in the school band, you know, marching in the football games and the Memorial Day parades. And then something happened. The Beatles came out, and every kid that could play music was started forming groups in their basement and playing Beatles songs and Ventures songs and, you know, Dave Clark Five songs and Louie Louie and stuff like that. And this was a continuing interest, although I never really believed that I could actually make a living playing music, especially rock and roll. It seemed to me that was a different breed of person than what I was. Like, that was somebody who grew up in Memphis, you know, or Liverpool, or in the 60s, San Francisco, you know. I was living in Pittsburgh and practicing in my basement, and the chances seemed pretty remote that I would become a rock star. Uh-huh. To me. Well, one thing led to another, and I went to college, and Tina and I met David Byrne, and we started playing together. At least David and I did in a band, and that later became the Talking Heads when we moved to New York.
Yeah, we wrote a song together in our studio called Psycho Killer. David came to us with some lyrics. He said, I've been approaching people and they won't help me with this because they think it's too morbid a subject. So we said, well, we'll help you. We understand what this is about. He said, I want it to be sort of like Alice Cooper. And so we wrote that song
This is true. He said he wanted it to be like Alice Cooper.
So this is how you first met with him, when he approached you to write the song?
No, actually, I first met him a couple years before that, when we were freshmen, and he was panhandling and playing the violin with a friend of his who played the accordion in front of the school refectory, they called it. He did this routine where he had a little bird perched on the bow of his violin. You may have seen that in cartoons, but this was in real life. And you know, we formed a little band called the Artistics, and we would play at the Valentine's Day ball and events like that.
So so David Byrne asked you both to work with him on Psycho Killer. What did you each contribute to it?
I think Chris contributed a verse. And I contributed a bridge and part of a verse.
Uh-huh. Well, why don't we play the record?
Sure.
This is from the Talking Heads' first album. This is Psycho Killer.
I'm tense and nervous.
That's Psycho Killer, and my guests are Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth. You know, it's such a great record, and one of the things that's really striking about it is that you've got this almost dance-like beat with this really nervous vocal. it's this great combination.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the really interesting things about Talking Heads, though, you know, especially in the early days, it seemed like an odd grouping in a way. You know, this rhythmic beat and a really nervous singer on top of it.
Yeah, well, everybody always said, oh, you want to be in a band, you've got to be different. So having been trained as artists, we sought to be different, and we also sought to work within the limitations of our playing abilities.
Well, let's talk about the limitations of your playing abilities. Tina, when you started playing with the Talking Heads, you had barely played much bass before.
I had not played bass at all. I had taught myself to play guitar and flute, and of course, I was an English handbell ringer. And I had sung, you know, in school, you know, chorales and stuff, but it was a new thing. But then I just did what every, you know, kid does when they want to start a band. I got my amp, I got my bass guitar, and I had a car. And so I was in, you know, and they had approached many bass players, and they just took one look at Chris and David, and they said, oh, you don't look right, you don't wear platform glitter shoes, and you have short hair. And so I said, well, look, you know, train me. Actually, it was Chris who really kind of pushed it.
Was there ever any objection to Tina playing, since she was a real newcomer to bass? Any dissension in the band about it?
It was because I was a girl.
The band at that time was just me and David. So, until Tina joined, and so he said, "Yeah, we'll give it a try," something like that, and we did, and. You know, once in a while, David and Tina would have a little argument about something, or a big argument about something, but it was never anything that was irreparable. And, I mean, if anybody thought that she couldn't do it, clearly they were wrong.
But Tina, let's get back to what you were just saying, that you were the girl in the band. Now, usually a woman in a rock band is, I don't know whether... they're sometimes forced into it, but frequently it's this like sex goddess image or earth mother image. But you really had neither of those images in the band. I remember seeing you in 1978, and you just stood there and played, and everybody in the band was dressed in a t-shirt and jeans, as I remember. But there was no special woman of the band image that you cultivated.
No, I was trying to avoid that because
we're working on that now.
We're
getting the woman thing together here.
I was thinking that it might be nice for women to see a woman who was just doing her bit, you know.
It was, by the way, very nice.
And I thought it was nice that I wasn't up at the front.
Right. So you are up at the front now. Are you changing your image for that? This is in Tom Top Club we're talking.
Yeah, I guess we are. For one thing, I like to see people really have a good time. And so I know that if I'm fronting the band and I don't move around, that means everyone else, as what they call supporting players, but they're really just as important, everyone else can't move either, because then it doesn't look good. And so so now I'm very, very physical, so that they can be very, very free, you know, to improvise, to act spontaneously. I always appreciated performances by James Brown, by Iggy Pop. Their way of showing their love and generosity for the public was by behaving in a very physical manner. So that image has changed. I'm no longer the young, classy admiral's daughter, would-be debutante. You know, I think now I'm a little bit closer to being one possessed at times, but I think that it's still not sexual, because I always hated that wimpy thing of girl bands, and I didn't like the masculine image either. I didn't think that was appropriate for women or natural, and I didn't want to do anything that felt unnatural.
Well, you know, you mentioned the sexual thing. I think a lot of times bands play off of any sexual energy they can generate between each other, and whether it's, you know, the guitarist and the bass player together, or, you know, a singer and the guitarist or whatever. And here you are in the band, actually married, and from the times I've seen Talking Heads, there isn't any of that sexual interplay. It's just straightforward music.
Right. We avoided it, the sex thing.
We have the sexual interplay after the show.
I think we were avoiding it because we were trying to find our own niche, you know, in music. And if you look around, you're still laughing. That's great.
Sorry, that was a cheap shot, Terry.
If you look around, you can you see that most of the music that's selling today is music that successfully merchandises sex on television.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really too much to do with music. But Talking Heads, we always wanted it to be about something larger than just about sex.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guests are Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth, the rhythm section of the band Talking Heads, and they have their own new album out with their group Tom Tom Club. The album's called Boom Boom Cha Boom Boom. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth are my guests. They're from the band Talking Heads. They also have their own group, Tom Tom Club. And the group will be beginning a national tour next week. Tina, you described yourself as an admiral's daughter, a would-be debutante. Chris, I think your father was in the military also, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he's a retired general.
When you first got started with Talking Heads, you were playing at places like CBGB's, where it was like the center of the punk scene. One of your first tours was with the Ramones. And I was wondering what kind of affinity you felt with the punk bands that you were grouped together with.
We felt that we were on the outside looking in, and that we weren't part of the mainstream, and these other punk kids weren't either. In fact, we were in an interview for Punk issue number one, and we were the first to say we have no heroes. You know, we don't think you have to be a technical virtuoso in order to play and to sound good. So that we shared with all the punks was the idea that the art is in the delivery and in the, you know, the message, and it's not necessarily that you have to, you know, get to Carnegie Hall in order to get your point across. And it was a very nice statement, too, that was being made, which was that anybody can do this. If you've got something to say, you can get up and do it.
Chris, how do you think Talking Heads has changed over the years musically?
Well, we've made these quantum leaps from time to time. At the moment, we haven't played together for over a year.
Right.
So I don't feel real great about that, but I have to tell you, the next time we get together, it's going to be a situation where we practically have to learn to play all over again. But what happened was we started off being really raw and really raggedy, but we played with great feeling, and somehow we got over on our feelings, because our feelings were maybe a little bit how should I say, undisguised by the usual trappings of show business. And then we one day we realized, hey, we're a lot better now. And we started to be able to, we added Jerry Harrison, for one thing, and so we became a quartet instead of a trio. And we made a big leap ahead. Like, our sound got a lot better, and our confidence was better as well. And we sort of stayed on that plateau for a couple of years. And then we did an album called Remain in Light, which more or less changed the way people, at least in our sphere of influence, thought about music, about popular music, that is. In other words, we incorporated a lot of elements that were not to do with rock and roll, but we kept a lot that were. So it was kind of like an African rock and roll, I hate to use that word, fusion, but it was a melding of different influences. And it was a dramatic quantum leap again for us, because It kind of took things to the next phase, as they say. But by the time we did that tour, which became the movie Stop Making Sense, we had refined our technique and also increased our, like, all singing, all dancing performance so that it was really happening.
Did watching yourselves and Stop Making Sense, the movie, have a big impact on you? I don't know how much you'd seen yourself perform before.
Huh, that's a good question.
Yeah, it had a big impact on me in that I could now understand why people were saying, "Oh, that was a great show. That was a great show." Because a lot of times when you're up there playing, you might not feel that great. Like you might even have the flu or something like that. But you have to go on, and particularly from a drummer's point of view, you're seeing the show in reverse, sort of. See everybody's backsides,
right.
You know. So it was very exciting for me to see how it built from the beginning to the end, and it was nice.
Well, it's always a shock, you know, because you know what they say: my face, I don't mind it, for I am behind it. It's the others in front that I jar. So that's always kind of a shock, you know, especially because, you know, as being a woman, I'm sure you can understand this. There's, you know, you grow up as a little girl, you think, well, one day you're going to grow up to be a princess. And somewhere along the way you find out, oh, I'm not going to be the beautiful princess. And I learned, you know, that I was going to have to work really, really hard. I imagined myself as having to support myself, that I would never marry. I really said, you know, I'm the ugly stepsister. I have beautiful sisters, by the way. I'm kind of the ugly duckling of the family. And so in a weird way, maybe I didn't sit back and wait for people to court me. I was...
She may be ugly, but she sure can cook.
Yeah. It is a shock to see yourself on film, but what I tried to do was see, well, am I doing the right things? Am I generating warmth, you know, towards the audience? You know, and I enjoyed being part of something that was larger than myself. I enjoyed being part of that large band and feeling that I was watching that band just as much as the audience was. I was enjoying it like it was a show for me, too.
Well, I regret that we're out of time. I thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Sure
thank
thing.
Thank you, Terry.
My guests have been Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth, the rhythm section of the Talking Heads. And they also have their own band called the Tom Tom Club. They have a new album called Boom Boom Cha Boom Boom. Tom Tom Club will be touring throughout May and June. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the history of Daffy Duck and Porky Pig with Steve Schneider. He's a historian of cartoons and the author of A History of the Warner Brothers Animation Studio. I hope you can join us. Here's more music from Tom Tom Club's new album.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Robert Ludlum was an actor and a producer, and by his own admission, wasn't very good at either. But he seems to be doing okay at his current job. Coming up, we meet the best-selling author of the espionage thrillers The Bourne Identity, The Osterman Weekend, and The Icarus Agenda. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the Smithsonian Institution's Anthology of American Musical Comedy, featuring Al Jolson, Bill Bojangles Robinson, Ethel Merman, and more. And do you remember a 1978 sleeper called I Want to Hold Your Hand? Critic Ken Tucker says if you missed the film the first time around, you have a second chance to catch it. It's now out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. At least 47 crewmen of the U.S. Navy battleship Iowa died in an explosion on board the ship today. NPR's Alex Chadwick has details.
The World War II vintage ship was taking part in maneuvers in the Western Atlantic. She was engaged in gunnery practice when something went wrong in the number 2 turret, which holds 3 16-inch naval guns, the biggest sea weapons the Navy has. An explosion ripped the turret, killing dozens of seamen and starting a fire. The crew managed to smother the flames, and they pumped seawater into the magazine where powder charges for the guns are stored in order to prevent more explosions that might have destroyed the entire ship. When the commanders had the emergency under control, they turned the ship toward Puerto Rico, where she'll put into port. The Navy will convene a formal board of inquiry to investigate the explosion on board the Iowa. This is Alex Chadwick reporting.
Two other Navy ships taking part in the same exercise as the Iowa collided in about 500 miles off the Florida coast. The frigate USS Tripp and the oiler USS Platt collided in early afternoon. The Platt has a 25-foot gash in the side. One crewman was slightly injured. Neither ship was in the same area as the Iowa. Defense and prosecution lawyers finished their closing arguments today at the trial of Oliver North. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Ollie North doesn't want to be a hero, defense lawyer Sullivan declared. He just wants to go home. Sullivan, his voice choking with emotion, quoted the Bible. Greater love has no man than he be willing to lay down his life for another. That's Ollie North, Sullivan whispered, his eyes seeming to tear. That's the kind of man Ollie North is. In a sense, he's a hostage, and I ask you on the evidence to set him free. In rebuttal, Prosecutor John Kecker told the jurors, you've heard a lot about courage at this trial, but there's another kind of courage, the courage to admit when you're wrong, the courage to admit personal responsibility, the courage to plead guilty when it's appropriate. Colonel North has not admitted to any of these things, the prosecutor told the jury, and it's time for you to do it for him. North sat erect during both closing arguments, barely moving a muscle except to take an occasional note. He showed no emotion. Tomorrow, the case goes to the jury. I'm Nina Totenberg at the federal courthouse.
The Attorney General of El Salvador was assassinated today as he drove to his office. Government authorities say assailants in a van placed a bomb on the roof of Roberto Garcia Alvarado's chauffeured car when it stopped for traffic. The Attorney General's bodyguard and driver received minor injuries. El Salvador's president-elect, Alfredo Cristiani, blamed Marxist guerrillas for the attack. So far, no organization has claimed responsibility. President Bush met with Jordan's King Hussein at the White House today for more than an hour. During the meeting, Mr. Bush urged Hussein to support mutually acceptable elections in Israeli-occupied territories that would include Palestinians. Hussein, however, would not endorse the election proposal and instead pushed the concept of a UN-sponsored international conference leading to direct negotiations. While Hussein is in the U.S., there is unrest in his country. In southern Jordan, police fired tear gas at demonstrators during the second day of violence in response to price increases. One person was killed during today's protest. 30 others were injured. Hundreds of Chinese students today continued pro-democracy demonstrations in Beijing. The students tried to force their way into the Communist Party headquarters. At least 1,000 riot police locked arms to block their way. Students shouted, Li Peng, come out, indicating that they wanted to speak with the Chinese prime minister. Thousands of supporters gathered in nearby Tiananmen Square. So far, there have been no reports of arrests or injuries. The protests started last week after the death of former Communist Party chief Hu Yobang, who was ousted for his reformist policies. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 7.5 points to close at 2386.91. Declines led advances 4-3 on volume of 193 million shares. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. No survey of 20th century music can ignore the contribution of the American musical comedy. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new set of albums from the Smithsonian Collection that include highlights from the turn of the century to Fiddler on the Roof. Here is Bill Bojangles Robinson singing and hoofing from Blackbirds of 1928.
Make 'em play that crazy thing again. I got to do that lazy swing again. Hi-ho, doing the new lowdown. Got my feet to misbehaving now. Got a soul that's not for saving now. Hi-ho, doing the new lowdown. That dancing demon, he has my feet in a trance. 'Cause when I'm dreaming, folks, I go right into that dance. Once you hear that haunting strain to it, I bet my life you'll go insane to it. Hi-ho, doing the new lowdown.
It was probably commerce, not a sense of history, that created the first original cast recordings. Now we can hear the fruits of those enterprises on this glorious set of American theater music. The Smithsonian has gathered some of the most memorable songs of the century, most of them sung by their original performers. There are history lessons, the origins of musical comedy and operetta, minstrel shows, social satire, and Tin Pan Alley, and lessons in stylistic authenticity. You'll hear legendary performers like Lillian Russell and George M. Cohan in their only commercial recordings, and forgotten stars like Edith Day on her enchanting 1920 recording of Alice Blue Gown. 18-year-old Wynne Murray, who stopped her very first show, Rodgers and Hart's Babes in Arms, singing Johnny One Note. And Adele Astaire, Fred's irresistible sister, who joins her brother in a couple of irresistible numbers, this one with George Gershwin himself at the piano.
Fascinating rhythm, got me on the go. Fascinating rhythm, I'm all a thrill of her. A lot of mess you make, hey, the neighbors want to know why I'm always shaking just like a flipper. Each morning I get up with a sigh. Start a hopping, never stopping. By that night the work has been done. I know that once it didn't matter, but now you're doing wrong when you start to patter. I'm so unhappy. Won't you take a day off, decide to run alone somewhere far away off and make it snappy.
I can think of few great stars who aren't here. You can hear Al Jolson, Eddie Cantor, Paul Robeson, Helen Morgan, Bill Bojangles Robinson, Danny Kaye, Ethel Waters, Ethel Merman, and Mary Martin in the freshness of their early success. And performers like Alfred Drake, John Raitt, who's Bonnie's father, Carol Channing, Rosalind Russell, Barbara Cook, Judy Holliday, Rex Harrison, Barbra Streisand, and Richard Burton in their most memorable musical roles. Practically every major songwriter or songwriting team from Victor Herbert to Stephen Sondheim is represented. There are also numbers from neglected shows like The Golden Apple by Jerome Morris and John Latouche. Kay Ballard is a turn-of-the-century American Helen of Troy, seducing a traveling salesman named Paris on a lazy afternoon.
It's a lazy afternoon, and the beetle bugs are zooming, and the tulip trees are blooming, and there's not another human in view but us two. It's a lazy afternoon.
There are fascinating surprises. Clifton Webb, Hollywood's classiest villain and the original Mr. Belvedere, was the suave song and dance man who in 1933 made the first recording of Easter Parade. In 1940, Mary Martin sang My Heart Belongs to Daddy with a sly sexuality that's a whole other story from her later, more wholesome image. Ethel Merman's original 1934 recording of Cole Porter's I Get a Kick Out of You, From Anything Goes, has a delicacy of phrasing that belies the cliché that she was only a brassy belter.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that get a kick out of you. Some get a kick from cocaine. I'm sure that if I took even one sniff, that would bore me terrifically too. Yet I get a kick out of you.
Did musicals after the war lose their buoyant sophistication, their inspired lunacy, their touching innocence? Did their seriousness get bloated, their sentimentality too calculated? With so much rare archival material at its disposal, maybe Smithsonian shouldn't have included so many shows whose original cast albums are currently available. Yet it's fascinating to hear the more recent songs in their historical or generic context. The Smithsonian collection makes a compelling case that the best American theater songs can match any of the world's great vocal music, pleasure for pleasure.
Vexed again, perplexed again, thank God I can be oversexed again. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I.
Vivian Siegel from Pal Joey, Lloyd Schwartz's classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Espionage, conspiracies, terrorists, and secret governments are the stuff of Robert Ludlum's international thrillers. Ludlum likes to keep his readers in suspense. Book critic John Leonard once wrote, "Ludlum tells a story like a man who must get it done before the house burns down around us. I sprained my wrists turning his pages." Most of Ludlum's books make it onto the bestseller lists. Some of his best-known novels are The Bourne Identity, The Parsifal Mosaic, and The Holcroft Covenant. Ludlum's book, The Osterman Weekend, was made into a film by director Sam Peckinpah. Robert Ludlum's latest book, The Icarus Agenda, is the number one bestseller on the New York Times paperback fiction list. It's set in the Middle East and in Washington. A group of Arab terrorists seize the American embassy, and an American congressman attempts to infiltrate the terrorists by posing as one himself. There are plot points that parallel the Iran-Contra affair, but Ludlum doesn't want to be accused of stealing from the headlines.
Contrary to what a lot of people think, and especially since my name was used so frequently during the Iran scam hearings, I believe Senator Rudman stood in the Capitol steps and said, "If Robert Ludlum had written this, I'd believe it, but not as fact. But I can assure you, no, it is not based on any particular event, and I finished the novel before the Iran scam hearings. I just wanted to get that out of the way, Terry, okay?"
Good enough. Well, speaking of the Iran-Contra hearings, though, did that make you think that truth is stranger than fiction?
No, it just sort of convinced me that my paranoia was not exactly, unrequited, as it were.
Well, you've been writing about secret governments for some time.
Yes, I have. I think one of my themes is the abuse of power, both elected and appointed.
There are secret governments. There are also, like, individual fanatics that you write about. Do you think that kind of fanaticism and those kinds of secret governments don't choose sides, that they are to be found in all in all political sides throughout the world?
Well, I think there's always a fringe, a lunatic fringe, on anything that is so absolute that does not consider the other fellow's point of view. In other words, people who don't want to negotiate are going to be fanatical. It's really a kind of a... You know, either or. You're either my way or else you're not. And that's the kind of blind thinking that I find so abhorrent, and that's why I write about it, I guess.
Now, your main character in The Icarus Agenda is a fairly unassuming guy, especially at the beginning, and he's someone who doesn't want a lot of attention.
Well, he's somebody who is not ambitious in the political sense, and that's why I... I might as well tell you that the reason why this book came about was that there are two existing realities that I loathe. One is the senseless violence of the Middle East, The other thing I loathe is what I call the manipulation of the body politic. Now, I'm talking about this country because I live here. We have the best system, I think, in the world, but nevertheless, there are the corruptors. And that's another thing I don't like. We're told things are one way, and you peel the layers away, and we find out it's something else. So I thought that if I could tell the story of one man crossing from one world into another, both parts of these worlds that I find outrageous, I thought it would make a more meaningful, possibly more powerful book.
Well, how about this? You also, I mean, there are people who get shot in your book, and you try to imagine what it would feel like. You know,
well, I was in World War II.
Were you ever shot?
No.
Do you ever wonder what it would feel like to be shot?
Well, of course, don't we all?
Yeah, I've dreamt about it many times myself, to tell you the truth.
No, I don't mean that, but I mean, you know, when you read about the violence that's taking place, you've got to put yourself in a victim's shoes every now and then. You can't help it. It's human nature to think, my God, what must it be like? I have been severely hurt. Yes, we all have, and the human condition can't take it. It's one of the reasons why there's no protagonist or no real character in any of my books that is severely wounded and gets up in the next chapter and chases the Indians. I mean, the human condition can't take that, and I try to explain that.
I read in one place that you ran away from home at the age of 14 to join the Marines, to lie about your age and join the Marines. And another place I read that at the age of 14 you ran away to be in the theater. I'm not sure if either of those things are true.
Well,
so maybe
there's a grain of truth in all of it, but it's true. I did not run away from home. I left home, and I left home originally to go on the stage. I was in Junior Miss and Janie in the Chicago, New York companies. And it's true that I did not join the Marines then. What I did was I tried to enlist in the Royal Canadian Air Force.
What kind of roles did you play when you were acting?
I either played homicidal killers or lawyers, and I've always thought there was a very definite connection. I was the guy that sent Siobhan McKenna to the stake in St. John, and he was a lawyer, of course. And then the next show I did on television, I can't even remember the name of the show now, but I think I was considered schizophrenic, paranoid, dangerous, and I'm not sure I was electrocuted, but I certainly should have been. I think both for the acting and the role, but nevertheless, it was.
Now, you did commercial voiceovers for a while, too, right?
Yeah, I know. It's morally one step below theft, but when you have a couple of kids in college, it doesn't hurt. No.
What kind of commercials did you do the voicing for?
Let's see. You know, there's so many that you do, and there's so many that you try out for. You're never quite sure. I do know that I was the voice of Braniff Airlines. You remember, you'll like flying Braniff style. And then, of course, there was the one years ago. I think I did it. I'm not sure, but should a gentleman offer a lady a Tipperillo? And then, of course, there was the plunge works fast. Let's not go into that. But no, it was thanks to a lovely agent. You know, people kept saying to me when I was an actor, boy, you'd make a terrific producer. And I got the message, you know, get off the stage. And so I did and became a producer. But when I did make the switch to, when I decided I really wanted to spend full time as a writer, to which my wife, who's a superb actress, thought she immediately thought she'd have to go back to work. She said, well, you're 40 years of age, Robert, and you might as well try it now, no matter how impoverished we may be. But I did have the voiceovers going, and I'm eternally grateful for it.
Did people used to recognize your voice?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
It was embarrassing?
No, not embarrassing, but they'd say, don't I know you? And I'd say, I don't think so. Say, I'm sure I know you. And I knew what they were thinking of. You know, I had just sold Tuna Helper to them 45 times or something, you know. But or Hamburger Helper, whatever that was, I don't know.
So when you dropped acting at age 40, what made you think you could actually write?
Well, I've been writing. I've been a closet writer for years. When I was coming back from the South Pacific, I wrote a book that I'm afraid on discharge, myself and several friends over-imbibed at the Top of the Mark in San Francisco, and I lost an 800-page manuscript. And to this day, I say to people, they say, my God, you really lost a manuscript like that size? And I always say, yeah, you never remembered Naked and the Dead? I don't think Norman really appreciates that story, but it's true.
Do you think that you write roles that you could play? Would you like to act the role of some of your main characters?
I think some of my actor friends would probably throw up at the thought, but but nevertheless, I've been offered a number of roles since I became a writer. Much more than I was ever offered as an actor. But No, I don't really think so. One, I couldn't take work from an actor. You know, they work too hard for a living. But no, I don't have any great desire to act again, no.
Well, I'm hardly the first person to point out that just about every one of your books has a three-word title.
Yes.
The Bourne Supremacy, yeah. The Aquitaine Progression, The Parsifal Mosaic, yeah. The Bourne Identity, The Mattery Circle, and on and on.
Yeah, well, I can tell you how it happened if you want to
know.
Yeah,
would you?
Yeah, the third or fourth book I wrote, the first book was Scarlatti Inheritance. The second, I think, was The Osterman Weekend. The third was Matlock Paper. Now, those were three-word titles because I felt they made sense. And I walked in with my fourth book, the publishers, and the title was Cable Tortugas. And here were these six people sitting around the table and looked at me like they were crying and weeping. And I said, my God, is it that bad? And they said, no, not the book. The book's all right, but the title. I said, what's wrong with the title? I mean, it says it. And they said, oh, no, you're identified with the three-word title. I said, what do you mean identified with it? I'm not identified with a popsicle, for heaven's sakes. Nobody knows who I am. They said, oh, no, and somebody in the New York Times had said I was identified. Well, you know, if it was in the New York Times, that's what they got to believe it, you know. And so I I said, okay, fellas, now, wait a minute. I stop crying. I said, now, this whole book is about an exchange, right? I mean, diamonds for gyroscopes. And they said, yeah, an exchange. And I said, a guy who does it named Reinman, right? And they said, yes. And I said, how about the Reinman exchange? Oh, thank you. And I said, oh, my God, it's the silliest day I've ever spent in my life. But ever since then, they've wanted the three-word titles, and now it's become a game for me. No, it's never been a conscious thing. It wasn't then. It is now. Now I know that, and I sympathize with them.
It's your duty to do it now.
Well, yeah, duty because they're nice people, and why not? And I think I'm a nice person, so we can compromise on this.
Robert Ludlum's latest book, The Icarus Agenda, is now out in paperback. This is Fresh Air. Time to see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams should have the answer to that.
Hi, Terry. Closing arguments tonight in the Oliver North trial, the Contra-Iran affair trial going on here in Washington. Also, we'll talk with a police sergeant in Indianapolis about the bombing there in a Kmart. A 5-year-old girl was severely injured, injury to her hand. She lifted up a toothpaste container that contained a very small pipe bomb. As of yet, no real motive, the police say, and they have a couple of suspects, people who were seen to be leaving the store quickly. We'll talk with David Horowitz, the author of the book called Destructive Generation, about what he considers to be the failure of the 1960s radical left.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The 1978 movie, I Want to Hold Your Hand, was different from other movies that took their names from Beatles songs. When it was first released, it was a commercial bomb. But critic Ken Tucker says he hopes the film does better now that it's out on home video. From the movie, here's comedian Will Jordan as Ed Sullivan coaching his ushers.
A few weeks ago, I went to England, and I saw these four youngsters perform. Both Sylvia and I agree that what they do to an audience is truly remarkable. So, I want you to be prepared for excessive screaming, hysteria, hyperventilation, fainting, fits, seizures, spasmodic convulsions, even attempted suicides. All perfectly normal. Merely means that these youngsters are enjoying themselves.
Few films have better captured the passion and camaraderie that rock and roll inspires than I Want to Hold Your Hand. The movie was written and directed by Robert Zemeckis, who later found fame as the director of Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Back to the Future. For I Want to Hold Your Hand, Zemeckis went back to the past, to Saturday, February 8, 1964, to be exact. That was the day before the Beatles made their American television premiere on The Ed Sullivan Show, and this movie follows the attempts of a group of young Beatlemaniacs to make contact with their heroes. These days, pop stardom is such a complicated yet common thing that it's hard to imagine how simple and unusual an event the Beatles were. It's a measure of how strong this movie is that it manages to recapture not only the hysteria of Beatlemania, but also the ideas and emotions that this rock band stirred up. Zemeckis took his built-in commercial disadvantage, the fact that none of the Beatles appeared in his movie, and turned it into an aesthetic advantage. This is the only rock movie ever made solely from the fans' point of view. And these fans aren't callow sheep either. Zemeckis captures young people at various phases of obsessiveness. The kids in I Wanna Hold Your Hand sneak into the Plaza Hotel where the Beatles are staying on the 12th floor. At one point, Rosie, played by Wendy Jo Sperber, meets Richard, a true zealot who has booked a room five floors below the Beatles and turned it into a shrine to the Fab Four. In this scene, Richard and Rosie obsess upon their heroes.
Now here, look at this, 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 look at this. This is my masterpiece. You know what this is? This is actually a clump of grass that Paul stepped on. I'm not exactly sure which blade he stepped on, but it's all in there. That's why I got such a big clump.
Oh, wow, can I have some of this?
What are you, crazy?
Oh, just a little bit, I'll buy it off of you.
No, I'm sorry, but it's not for sale.
That's Eddie Deason as Richard, enacting nerdiness with a precision that no one else has topped. While Zemeckis certainly stretches Beatle fan craziness to comic extremes, he manages to avoid virtually all the cliches of both rock films and teen movies. His teens are real people, not vulgar stereotypes. Not that Zemeckis is above some good vulgarity. Nancy Allen has a terrific solo scene in which, having entered Paul McCartney's hotel bedroom, she very nearly makes love to the neck of his bass guitar. Ever since the assassination of John Lennon, it's been difficult to remember the joy and passion that the Beatles set loose in the world. I Wanna Hold Your Hand will make you remember. Other new video cassette releases include Dead Ringers, director David Cronenberg's psychological thriller, starring Jeremy Irons in a dual role as a pair of very odd identical twin gynecologists. The movie isn't nearly as violent or gory as many of Cronenberg's films in the past, but that's not a sellout either. This most emotionally complex of the Canadian director's films ended up on a lot of critics' 10 best lists late last year.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Cameron Crowe graduated from high school early, but then returned to school as an undercover journalist. The result was Crowe's best-selling novel, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He also wrote the screenplay for the film. On the next Fresh Air, Cameron Crowe will tell us about his new movie, Say Anything. It's also a teen film, and he both wrote and directed it. And we'll find out what film critic Stephen Schiff thinks of this new movie. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review new releases from four female country singers. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Ed Dougherty, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Deborah Beagle and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.